statement.
So you don't complicate it, but I think to, as you indicate, to bring the whole bar committee in on it now.
No, I trust that everyone here is aware that Professor Arthur and Professor Platt are reporters who are going to be doing much of the drafting on the entire code as we go along.
It helped a lot to read all the minutes.
You know, I did.
Did you read our bulletin?
I like that. You talked about specific cases. I look at the definitions on page 2, appropriate or deprive, and deprive. To deprive another property means to withhold it or cause it to be withheld from him permanently or for so extended a period or under such circumstances that the major portion of its economic value or benefit is lost to him. And appropriate means to exercise control over it or aid a third person to exercise control over it permanently or for so extended a period or under such circumstances as to acquire the major portion of its economic value or benefit. Now, I'm thinking specifically now in terms of the larceny by Bailey statute that presumably we'd be doing away with by adopting this. And I think of a specific case involving a car where a person rents car, and I had innumerable of these cases as a prosecutor and some as a defense attorney. I rent a car from Hertz, and I'm supposed to bring it back in a week. I don't bring it back in a week. In fact, I don't bring it back until 3 months later when a warrant was issued for my arrest, and they arrest me up in Ontario still driving this Hertz car. All right. Now, I clearly was a bailee. I failed to abide by the terms of my bail. Some district attorneys take a different position with respect to the offense. Some would charge me with grand larceny presently. Some would charge me with larceny by bailee. And this particular problem has been resolved differently by different trial judges in Multnomah County on motions for a direct verdict. But look at that problem in the context of the definition that we have here. There's no evidence. If I haven't altered the license plate, haven't changed the color of the car, haven't tried to re-register it in my name, there's no evidence here that I've tried to withhold it from Hertz permanently. And I couldn't get, and the prosecution couldn't get to the jury with that. Similarly, are the circumstances such that it could be said that in this instance that I've withheld it from the owner for such an extended period or under such circumstances that the major portion of its economic benefit or value is lost to the owner. Say it's a 1968 shift, I've had it for 3 months. Is the major portion of its economic value lost to the owner?
Are you asking whether it's implicit in here, whether the economic value has been lost during the period that it was withheld?
Yeah, right. I'm saying do we reach this type of a bail and offense?
Did you intend to pay the daily rent in the meantime?
I didn't do it, no.
Or intended to?
Well, yeah, I testify on my own defense that I sure as hell did.
Steal larceny if I could. You won't count on how hard you
did it.
Well, you said that you got home and had a permanent drive. That was the question.
under less than permanently deprived.
Yeah.
By statute.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do we leave a loophole here? Do we not?
Well, first of all, we're tightening something and leaving fewer loopholes, because at the common law you have to permanently deprive. So we're going to sweep in a few more.
Well, larceny by Bailey wasn't a private common law, was it?
Right. Right. But for larceny by Bailey, wouldn't you necessarily have had to permanently deprive? The question, you gained possession rightfully rather than trespassory, and this is the distinction between the two, which you still have.
Right.
So we're doing something there here. We'll see a few more people into the liability, it seems to me.
Well, aren't what your example isn't what you're really talking about the gist of it, the intent to permanently deprive rather than the actual permanent deprivation of the property. In other words, I think within the framework of the definitions here, and under the draft of larceny, we say a person commits larceny when with the intent to deprive another of property. And we go back to the definition. Well, what does deprive mean? It means either to withhold it. In other words, we're just further defining what the intent to deprive means. In other words, I don't think that you'd be in trouble getting a conviction there because he hadn't kept it for such a period of time that the economic value hadn't been lost. I think the thrust of
what is his intent?
It's a question of what he intended to do, not what he did.
Of course, you go beyond that. I said, or for so extended a period of time, or under such circumstances as to acquire. Your 3 months case, I think it would be quite clear. What if it were 2 days? Then the next thing is to acquire a major portion of its economic value or benefit. Does that refer to that period of time that you had it? Or does it refer to permanently?
What does the intent refer to?
Well, it says intent to deprive someone of the larceny. With intent to deprive. Deprive means to, so it means with an intent to either withhold it or cause it to be withheld permanently or for so extended period of time.
Yeah.
And when was the intent as of what time? The reason he took it, or at the end of the time you told the guy, Kurtz is telling him that you're going to bring it back.
But it's intent to deprive or intent to appropriate.
Well, now, the committee doesn't think that it's a problem. I don't know whether it is or not.
Well, it might be a problem to some prosecutor that this goes before, but it has inherent in it civil things, problems, maybe a point of criminal conduct that's too close to civil liability to completely define.
I don't know how you can define it any better. You might if you tied the appropriation time, but whatever we do here, there will, if we try to spell things up too well, then we are restricting things.
That's right.
Amen.
That's right. But what we have to be prepared to do, whether we individually are in the majority or the minority on the commission's posture with these specific statutes, we have to be able to stand collectively against those various special interest groups like the car rental agencies,
solving the problem. And after all, this is what we're interested in, is in solving the problem of society or of a particular industry or business where these things are occurring. What kind of tricks or devices or means and so forth are they using? How is it possible by this kind of knowledge, a better job can be done in drafting or analyzing the problem that you're trying to solve?
Well, one thing, Gordon, we could do very easily, and that's whenever we have a specific problem such as this that confronts us and we don't know exactly what the answer is, we could contact the New York, the Illinois, the Connecticut, right, and people say, did you have this problem? If so, how did you resolve it?
If we don't solve the problems of these large pressure groups, then we really aren't doing anything as far as legislation is concerned. We're just wasting time. Because we just solve the problem to satisfy what we think may be the problem. We're not doing anything. We're not doing a thing.
We're not getting anywhere.
Well, that's true to a certain extent. But look at these exhibits A, B, and C, the various statutes. How do you think they got on the books? Because of these pressure groups.
I quite agree, but you realize what I'm saying is that if we don't change it for the better, then we aren't doing anything.
Yeah, but for the better of the pressure groups?
No, but we must consider their problem because, look, all right, Safeway. Safeway is, sure, that's a pressure group and they have a terrific lobby and all of that. But still, they deal with a large segment of the public and they deal with them satisfactorily, too, where they wouldn't be where they are. And if we can't write the laws to solve the problems of Safeway along with umpteen thousand other people, if we aren't solving the great problems of the public, then we might as well leave this law the way it is.
Well, here's one thing, I'm not so concerned about that, because certainly in these other states, in California, Illinois, New York, New Mexico, Connecticut, Georgia, they have Safeway stores or stores that are comparable to them that were just as aware of these problems as we are, and yet they came forth with something of the type that we're contemplating. I think Gordon's suggestion to contact them, the attorney for them, is excellent.
Right.
But it doesn't bother me too much because we have precedent and the experience of other states that face the same problem and the same. And they're organized to the extent that I suppose that they represent or constitute a pressure group just as strong as any we have in Oregon.
Well, my experience in legislature has been that the legislature doesn't always do what it should have done.
Well, that's true.
And
that's true.
I particularly don't trust California and New York and Illinois as much as I do Oregon. I think Oregon has a fine legislature, but they still don't come up with the.
How much money went into the model penal code? In excess of $1 million, wasn't it? In actual appropriated money. It was in excess of $1 million. 10 years of work went into that. Now, if we can't place some credence upon that, well, we just as well quit if we're going to be fearful or suspicious of everything we do.
New York has spent $500,000 at least. That's conservative.
Well, that is true, but I still reserve judgment on it because I think they come up with some terrible bloopers. Even with spending all that money, they still make some terrible errors.
And we can always correct the bloopers that we made. That's why the legislature's here.
And as you said a bit ago, Tony, some of these have been in effect long enough.
Yes.
To get the answer from them. How is this word? Is it required amendment?
Look at the Uniform Commercial Code.
Yeah.
We were all fearful of that. Sometimes I regret very much that it's in effect in Oregon.
Well, I think that we, one of our objectives is ultimately to save the state money, because I think by doing away with some of the duplicitous statutes, we have four separate statutes on life, larceny and livestock. We've got two relating to shoplifting. Question that you raised with respect to receiving and concealing. There are so many areas of appeal inherent in that particular statute we passed on some of the last couple of years that were I appointed to represent somebody, I'd be obliged.
and let's do it. But I think we ought to consider all the information they have to give us and not insulate ourselves too much from those people, because my experience has been that they have a terrific interest in this and a terrific amount of information they can give us. Sure, sometimes you just have to discard everything they say, and other times they've got the key information that we want, and boy, we better have it in there.
Well, I think you're right. I think we should move cautiously, but certainly not fearfully. Because if we do a proper job on this, I dare say that we'll help everybody.
True.
The prosecutor, the credit grantor, and then everyone else.
True.
And I think the past experience probably is of these other states demonstrates that.
We simply must have good information before we move. We can't make a good decision in Oregon without...
We could also... I suspect that we're going to have to go before the emergency board anyway. As a matter of fact, I've already planted the seed, to be honest with you, because I think we will need more funds. But if necessary, there's nothing to prevent us. I'm sure we can get the funds of sending Don back after he has a group of specific problems to whichever one we select, of whether it's New York or Connecticut or California or Michigan, and have him personally go there and explore these things and see how they met these problems that we're raising here. And it might be well to do that. You couldn't go with him, Mildred.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah, I was making my plan.
I make an observation in general again, that one of the things that this committee and the commission itself will have to resist constantly, and a large part of it, I believe, will come from the special interest groups, and that's the desire of the special interest groups and the public at large for vengeance rather than deterrence in the criminal law. Now, I don't want to impute to the Safeway stores that their motive for coming in for a strict shoplifting statute is vengeance, but I have a feeling that there's a lot of that there. That's a popular reaction to criminal law. And this is part of the thing that you must resist, and which doesn't mean you should insulate yourself, but I think that will rear its head time and time again from all the groups.
I think as you go through some of the penalty provisions that we have now, you can see that at least you can assume that this has had a lot to do with some of the real stiff penalties for certain types of conduct. It's very similar to what you find in some other statute with a minor penalty. Just some small difference. I would think that a lot of this has grown up through the years because the thought being, well, if we make it a big enough penalty, it's going to deter people, and it hasn't. You know, so you end up with some rather strange penalty provisions with some of these statutes. For example, some of the embezzlement statutes, there's one where, I believe, if the Portland Port Commissioner uses his maximum 20 years.
And
$50,000 fines, whereas if the state treasurer doesn't, it's 2 years.
No, that's a little hard. If you drop a taxi cab driver, it's 10 days. $25.
If you take all his clothes and put him out naked, it's nothing.
It's a little hard to reconcile some of those family
conditions. Well, the hardest job that a district attorney has, I think, is decide when he should issue a bad check or when he should say, I'm not going to be a collection agency. And this is a problem that you wrestle with, I'm sure, Don, many times. We're not going to be able to solve that problem, and we're not going to be able to
about, that is to say, the automobile section and the credit card section, because I would hope that by the time we next meet, or when we next meet, that we could make some policy decisions with respect to these two areas. Are we going to keep the taking without intent to deprive, the taking and using statute? Are we going to keep the essence of that in our revision, or are we going to do away with it and just have the taking of an automobile strictly construed as larceny, period? Maybe you have some other ideas that you haven't gotten to with respect to this comprehensive theft statute. I don't know.
Well, certainly more background information is going to be needed, and this is my thinking that after I got the initial reaction from the subcommittee to the draft in its present form, that I would be able to devote some time to further research and getting some additional information background that would help you in evaluating this. For example, just on the Oregon cases alone, there's a great amount of time to yet be spent in going back through more of the Oregon cases. All I've tried to do here is just to give you a sampling, a cross-section, to show you that what's proposed here is not going to do any great violence to the traditional fundamental concepts, but it's just going to merely expand them, and it's going to, and some of the cases I've cited point up some of the technical distinctions that are drawn presently and have been drawn among larceny and embezzlement and obtaining. But beyond that, there's a lot of background research that has to yet be done on.
In that regard, and maybe this is embarrassing, but I'm going to direct it to our two professors present. Are there resources, student resources, available at Willamette and Oregon to whom you can designate specific research projects to help relieve Don of this burden?
Well, that's already been done.
It's been done.
Those here have been assignments made. I think I'd like to respond to that and say that this has been done, and I'm less enthusiastic about the total effectiveness of it than I was at one time. There are only so many students. Some of them work part-time. They've got terrific incentives to get into school. Some of them do research under a work-study program with Office of Economic Opportunity grants. In the case of the Willamette students, I got a little too enthusiastic and assigned about six of them to what I thought would be a part that I would be involved in, and it isn't perhaps specific enough. Now they're already launched in. Now at Oregon, I must speak for George, but they're in the midst of about to finish a quarter and to be in the midst of examination, so for that time, they can't do anything. There are real resources there, but somewhat limited. This is the old side. We had enough money, we could hire some more assistants for Don and have this going on a professional basis all the time. Law students are small people, but there are some limitations.
Yeah, well, I'm, of course, this is purely experimental with you and me both, and I haven't yet been able to get my students to work because of the restrictions on their time. They will not be available for spring term begins March 25th, which time we have assignments already waiting for. Enthusiasm will carry a student a long way in a project like this, but I don't know how far it'll carry it myself. In other words, the effectiveness of the aid we give you is a complete question mark. This is a volunteer project, and we won't be able to tell you for weeks whether it's going to be really effective.
Good.
Well, we
it will at least constitute food for thought.
We appreciate immensely the help that.
I suppose what I'm saying is that I'm giving you a word of caution, and I think that's important to doing too.
Yeah. I think we're both just utterly fascinated by this. They couldn't have anything more exciting. Up at the University of Washington, they have a law school policy now that no teacher teaches more than 4 contact hours a week. He's in the classroom 4 hours, and he's expected to do this kind of thing.
And the teacher is.
Big pardon?
The teacher is expected.
Yeah, in addition to his classroom work of 4 contact hours. Well,
interject one comment. You see, what we've been doing and attempting to do up to now is feel our way to see how this is going to work out, because there's no question about it that when you look at the approach we're taking as compared with some of the other states, well, Michigan, for example. Now, Michigan, they have the bar, the state bar there, underwrote a good percentage of the overall cost and paid for, although the law school, the Michigan Law School, absorbed part of the cost in just relieving the two reporters from their teaching duties. And they were paid just to draft the Michigan Code. That's what they did. And up to now, you see, our reporters are working gratis. They've given their time a great deal, but up to now, and contemplate giving a great deal more, you see. So,
I hasten to add, but I'm getting a great deal back.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, but at the same time, I want to point out that the thing is that we're fortunate enough to have two gentlemen here who are willing to do this without any promise at this stage of anything but a lot of grief and hard work. We are into the initial stages here, and I think that considering the fact that we haven't yet really had an opportunity to see what kind of a product we're going to get out of the students, I think that the manner in which we've approached this is really the only workable thing up to now, the only workable way to do it up to now. I would like to have another $50,000 or so to hire research assistants, but that isn't feasible. But I think that we can still, because we've got such a vast amount of material to draw upon, I think we can still come up with a darn good product here and have a good modern code. It may not move along as rapidly as we'd like it to, but I think that we've got the advantage, as Senator Turey said, we've got the advantage of, like actually the New York, or the Model Penal Code, they worked 10 years on that. The New York code, they spent six years on. And spent a great deal more money. Michigan spent at least $100,000 on this project. Some of these questions, we may have to change our thinking as we go along. This may not work out with these students on a voluntary basis, and we may have to face up to the fact that in order to keep people interested in this, we're going to have to pay them something. You know, pay them the student research rate at least.
Moving on to something a little bit different. Tony, when do you expect to have the next full committee meeting?
I don't know. I was going to talk about that, see what Don thinks. But it won't be before a month. But I think to a large extent, it's going to depend upon what you're going to do, your subcommittee.
Well, everybody here has terrific professional responsibilities of his own and demands on his time. However, I think that the success of our endeavor is necessarily going to demand a certain personal sacrifice on everyone's part, and I would think that we should have another subcommittee meeting go back over this and implement the thoughts that have come out today and the additional material that Don will send us in a couple of weeks. Now that's going to push you, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think that I would like to say this. I think that this approach to it is a mistake. I think that what we had here this morning could have been a far better job than appears before you if I had not been fighting a self-imposed time restriction here. In other words, I think that some of these things are, you just don't know how long it's going to take. I should have spent another 3 or 4 weeks on this really to have this in the proper form to show to you.
I'm not so sure that's correct. At least we have a starting point, and we've pointed up the things that we want. You bet.
Well, are you saying
for me to say that in 2 weeks I can have this ready for another meeting? I can't, really, because I can have something ready for you, but whether it's the kind of product that would warrant another meeting, I can't say, because this may take me longer than 2 weeks to do a creditable job on it. Because, you see, with the theft statutes, now the assignments that have been made to Professor Arthur and Platt cover other areas. They don't cover the theft statutes. So as far as the research and the drafting and all of it is with respect to the theft statutes, I've done that myself. And recognizing my own limitations, in fairness to the subcommittee, I think that
you're thinking that your task can be made a little bit easier if we don't set the next subcommittee meeting date today, but that we wait and set it at a later date.
Well, I'd like to be given an opportunity to see, spend a few days on it or a week to see how it's coming along, and then contact you and say,
well, Don, let me ask something. Perhaps there isn't a complete meeting of the minds here. What is it you have in mind that you will have to have prepared prior to this next subcommittee meeting?
Well, number one, I want to draft additional articles to go into this, articles on dealing with affirmative defenses, articles dealing with taking and using, and with the comment that would go along with them to help explain what I have when it's prepared. I would like to be given an opportunity to collect some additional background information with respect to the suggestion that Professor Arthur brought up, some of the commentary, and circulate that among the members of the subcommittee before the next meeting.
That's what you had in mind also.
I would envision double checking these statutes so I can give you a reasonably accurate idea of what statutes are going to be appealed, repealed, or amended, perhaps, in some respect. And this is all, particularly the checking the statutes, even with the help of legislative counsel, this is all time consuming.
Don, would it be possible to arrange? I'd be happy to request it if you wished, or I think you could probably do it. Make arrangements to have legislative counsel assign one member who will sit in at the subcommittee meetings and the committee meetings.
I've already done that, Mr. Chairman. Kathleen Beaufay has been assigned to work with this committee on this. She isn't here today because her mother is ill.
Oh, I see.
She's having an operation, and that's why Kathleen is.
We have reason to expect that in the future she will be attending.
She's been very helpful and has worked hard on this thing. As a matter of fact, the research forms, legislative council put those together.
Well, let me shift to something else to feel get the committee's consensus. We met here today on Saturday, and we're going to break in a minute. Mildred, if she were a court reporter, she had started a 2 o'clock trial. It would be 6:30 now. She was sitting there slaving away. We're not being very kind to her. The next meeting we have would the committee just as soon meet on Saturday? Would you prefer to meet on Friday late afternoon, say?
Where?
Well, that's...
The answer to that might depend on where.
Well, that raises problems. There are a couple of us that come from Portland. There's a couple that come from Bend. One from Eugene, and there are a couple here in Salem, right?
Bend and Salem's about as easy as Portland and vice versa, but
yeah.
Eugene, Salem would be a lot easier.
Right.
I think that George would be the only one that would really be hampered particularly. because it isn't much of a run from Salem to Portland, but it is from Eugene.
Saturday strike everyone's convenience. Are you?
Have more chance to attend on Saturday than other days.
Saturday's about the only time, really.
It would be inconvenient to have late afternoon meetings and go into the evening hours.
Yeah, if you're going to go from Eugene to Portland, it's damn inconvenient, isn't it?
And I don't think you're mentally alert.
My class schedule this spring will be at the end of the week. So that when I attend on Saturday, I'll have to move class as it is. But if I had to come Friday, I'd have to stay overnight perhaps, and this would disrupt two classes. So that would be, as far as my teaching commitments go, somewhat more of a burden. I'm not quite sure that it would work, that 2 days would be lost. But I do have what's known as preparation time to consider for the class. And that really is the great bulk of the time.
Well, let's reserve. We won't set a date today for the next subcommittee meeting. I'll be in touch with Don to check his progress and ideas to when we can have our next meeting. We'll reserve to a later date the selection of the time and place of our next meeting. Now, I don't know, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Supreme Chairman, how much we conform today with the Commission's directive as far as the subcommittee's work is concerned, but I think probably it's about time and grace.
I think this is extremely productive, frankly. This is the type of thing that I would hope that all the subcommittees would do.
If you want to meet our office, we would have a
We'll be in touch.
Yeah, I didn't thought of it.
Yeah, that would be fine because it certainly is more than adequate. Anybody else have any closing comments?
Well, I would just like to make one more comment, although certainly I think it's extremely valuable to have Professor Arthur and Professor Plant here for these meetings. I might point out that they have been assigned to be reporters for specific areas, and as such are assigned to other subcommittees and not subcommittee number one, in as much as I'm serving as reporter for subcommittee number one. And I would just like to make this comment that certainly if they can arrange to be here, I think it's extremely valuable to have them here. But as they get into these other areas, they might be asking quite a bit of them when they're working on the preliminary article drafts to take time to come to the next subcommittee meeting of the theft statute.
Right.
You see. So.
Well, we want them to know they're welcome, but we won't hold them against them if they don't come.
Very good news.
Of our February 24th meeting had were mailed out to all of you, and I'm going to ask that the reading of these minutes be dispensed with unless anybody has any corrections or additions to the minutes. And if not, they'll be approved as prepared. Now, you were all mailed preliminary draft number 2 on our larceny statute. It's in one of these blue binders. And my understanding, you correct me if I'm wrong, Don, that this is essentially the same as the preliminary draft number 1, except that you incorporated some of the suggestions that we had at the last subcommittee meeting and made some other changes.
Well, and it's substantially the same. Of course, on the agenda, we're going to call upon Kathleen Beaufay, who prepared this second draft. And I thought she could point out what changes have been made and how it differs from the first draft, and also at the same time discuss the fact that it's going to have on the present ORS provisions.
Okay, well, before we get to Kathleen, do you have any general comments that you want to make after yourself?
Well, no, not at this point, Mr. Chairman. I think that before we adjourn here today, there are some other things I think we should discuss, but I think that logical approach to start with here would be to have Kathleen discuss what the second draft accomplishes.
Okay, Kathleen, our favorite legislative counsel, would you tell us what you think about it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in revising the draft, of course, you had made suggestions to Don the last time about the changes in terminology which are incorporated in the draft. The other basic change, other than the fact that incidentally I omitted unintentionally the definition of the word property.
That's my first question.
It raises an interesting question because in the general definition of the statutes, the word property is defined, and I think this is something we'll have to watch all the way along.
Where is that?
In 161.010, the whole series of definitions that apply to crimes and criminal procedure defines the word property as including both real and personal property. The definition you're talking about is somewhat broader, and Don and I have talked about the possibility of keeping a kind of a card file on terms as you define them in working with various of these crimes and looking up the definition for the particular crime, then to decide later whether or not you want to put those definitions all at the beginning of the code or incorporate them as they come along affecting certain. That's a kind of a codification decision that for the time being doesn't need to be made, but I didn't happen to know that because one of the things Don asked me to do was keep an eye out on the statutes, which are not subsumed necessarily within this draft, but may have a little bit and piece that needs to be deleted because it's already covered in this one. So this is one of the things I have done. But in the draft, basically the changes I made were in form and style, reorganizing and paragraphing and so forth.
And you were using his preliminary draft as...
That's right.
All right.
And I would call this kind of a topical form and style revision more than any substance. If I affected the substance, and I did in one case, I found out it was completely inadvertently, but it raised the life of policy decision for you in the process. I misread or whatever Don's draft to the extent that I very carefully excised the provision that would have made simply the act of writing a bad check a crime. I was so thinking in terms of larceny that the only thing I was thinking of is if you get something from the check, fine, you know, we're in the larceny statutes, but. And so some of the language that he had which would have indicated that the mere act of writing a bad check was a crime disappeared in the shuffle. Now that's a somewhat separate act in any event from larceny. So when he and I discussed it, we decided it wasn't worth preparing another draft and shipping out to the place and point this out. Now I separated, or hope to, the straight act of larceny. We simply say a person commits larceny and does A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Then where A, B, C, D, E, F, G needs some amplification as to exactly with what intent and what technique and so forth the person, for instance, issues a bad check, we give you the act necessary to describe what it is, what circumstances are prerequisite to issuing or committing the act of issuing a bad check or committing the act of larceny by extortion or larceny by false promise. Larceny receiving stolen property or larceny servitude. This is thrown out tentatively for you to review kind of an idea as to whether or not you like that particular format. I thought it made it somewhat easier perhaps if you're in a hurry looking up larceny to generally get a picture of what acts constitute larceny and then you can refer yourself to the particular section to get the details. Then we run into, and then the latter part of course involves the question of punishment, and that is, you then talk about larceny in the first, second, and third degree. And it is interesting to note those particular sections are probably going to eliminate more of the state law on larceny than anything else, because an awful lot of our law, once you get to the point that it is larceny, deals with the circumstances under which it's committed in order to invoke a greater or lesser penalty. For instance, larceny of a railroad train that is moving is punishable by a considerably higher sentence than larceny if it's from the railroad train. I guess it isn't moving or whatever. But we found in checking through these, I think maybe 35 of these sections that deal with larceny. The only thing they really deal with is the penalty, not with the act itself, because of the varying circumstances. And I picked up in checking additionally later an additional 3 or 4 documents that are the same kind of thing. I mean, they're not as well organized in that case as one might expect. Or cool. So, well armed with a dangerous weapon, well not armed with a dangerous weapon, that kind of thing. So you're going to get rid of an awful lot of those if you boil these down into this degree type approach.
Can I, in order to start it off, begin to ask you some questions, beginning with your definition section?
Sure.
Right. I won't do it until you've finished your general comments, but it might be easier for the committee if we just go right straight through this from the beginning to the end.
Does everyone have a copy now of preliminary draft number 2?
All right, now, in preliminary draft number 1, we define property as any article, substance, or thing of value, including money, etc., and then we had some discussion as to whether that should read including but not limited to money, tangible, and intangible, personal property, etc. Do I understand that your omission of that in preliminary draft number 2 was simply an oversight, and you would agree that a definition of property properly belongs here in section 1?
That's correct.
All right. Does the committee agree? Now, does the committee have any view with respect to the semantics of this, that is to say, including money, etc., or including but not limited to? Would it not be that the traditional language and that which is presently in the ORS says including but not limited to? Are you conversing with that, Kathleen?
Well, the present one simply says includes both real and personal property.
Yeah, but that's the general one.
That's the general
right?
one, right.
Under 161. Yeah.
Right. But I'm talking about in chapter 164. I think it's generally pretty much agreed that
should be as broad as I think. The problem is going to be the efforts that are going to be made on this. Time goes along, it's narrow enough to broaden, I think. So I'm starting out with a broad language, and that leaves some room.
Would you agree, Mr. Spalding?
Yes, I thought we agreed to that last time.
Right.
That
was okay. Then I don't think we necessarily need a motion to direct that as we finalize this, sub 1 of section 1 will define property as it was defined in sub 1 of the preliminary draft with this amendment, including but not limited to.
All right.
Now, going down the definitions, I'm wondering the language that we use, appropriate, obtain, so on and so forth. These definitions have been taken out of Supreme Court definitions. Is this right on most of these?
The definitions, the definition that appeared in the first draft followed pretty closely the definition that appeared in the
with the exception that, as did the model penal code, their proposed official draft, my first draft stated that property, included the language tangible and intangible personal property, and the reason that I included that was because of the Towshire case, State versus Towshire, and this was a case we discussed the last time.
Right.
And this, so as far as Oregon case law, this this language would be to avoid the kind of problem that appeared in Towshire. But beyond that, of course, real property appears in the definition already.
Now, how about this? What is sub one of preliminary draft two? Appropriate property of another. The definition that you secured from that. Have you double checked that to make sure that this definition of appropriate doesn't conflict with any case law definition of appropriate? So, assuming that we pass this, we don't have a situation later where the statute conflicts with the previous interpretation.
To my knowledge, I've been unable to find any cases that would be in conflict with this definition.
Okay. And this would be true with respect to deprived property of another, obtained, and owner, right?
Yes.
Okay. My thought would be that, well, we could go ahead and make some possibly vote, make some recommendations today with respect to this, that we should ask Don, this is a kind of thing that he could ask the law school committee to have to double check on for us, so that we're absolutely sure.
Well, I think that, of course, this is an area where I'm looking to legislative counsel to help cover our flank, so to speak. The law, the problem of assigning this type of thing to the law students at this point is that they're just getting underway with the assignments that have already been made. I think this double-checking type of thing, Kathleen and the good offices of legislative counsel are extremely competent in this area. And, I think that it's checked initially by the draftsman and then double-checked by legislative counsel. I would, don't you think, Kathleen, that that would be sufficient safeguard?
I think one of the problems that we're going to run into, Senator, on this is the, I don't know if you happen to notice, but Portland, they haven't carried any report last week about the judge down from the down ruling on a case on the definition sort of thing in a circuit court. Well, unless it gets appealed, we're never going to find out what the Supreme Court acts on it. But Don and I discovered that his interpretation of the statute, and of course we run into this in all fields of law, criminal law, so it's an interesting one at this point. His definition and the way he interprets that statute isn't the way we interpret it. And of course, since the Supreme Court doesn't seem to have answered that specific question, we find some of these problems, and then if we can find a case at all, it's all right. What we're probably going to run into, I think, is where we've got 22 jurisdictions within the state that may manage to have any variety of opinions as to exactly what somebody's terms use.
Yeah, but you can, it isn't too much of an imposition on you to ask you to double check these definitions.
No, it's part of the drafting thing, and I think that we've already discussed a couple of these questions on some of these definitions.
Okay, now, I want to direct the committee's attention to appropriate. And in preliminary draft number 2, 1A, defining appropriate, you say exercise control over property of another, or to aid a third person to exercise control over property of another. But in the preliminary draft, you said simply exercise control over it, or to aid a third person to exercise control. Now, maybe I'm nitpicking, but why the change?
Well, that's mine, Senator, rather than Don. I'm very unenthusiastic any other effort to shorten the text necessarily to do this. So this is something that was done as a kind of automatic, maybe it's a visceral reaction of mind and practice.
Okay. Now, I would assume that the committee agrees that this is a desirable change. What about, does the committee see any question on this very same thing, language, exercise control over it permanently, or for so extended a period, or under such circumstances as to acquire the major portion of its economic value or benefit? Is that a good criterion?
We discussed that a little bit last time, didn't we?
Right.
That this was pretty well embodied in the decision and so forth.
Senator, my difficulty is, maybe I shouldn't be here, because I simply have the intellectual horsepower to go as fast as you must go and will be going and are going. I can't keep up with it. I look quickly at the model penal code of the New York business, and I don't see appropriate at all. I see deprive, and I see other terms, and I have questions, kind of lumped on questions as I go along, and I think this could be an interminable thing that we're doing, and perhaps I shouldn't raise that question, but what is the source of appropriate? Is that
New York?
Yeah, that's from the New York code.
Probably
didn't get
you. Well, I'm the commissioner. I'm sorry. I've got the wrong code.
The New York is set out in the blue binder there.
I must get my blue binder.
You have a copy of that?
Something here. Must have it. Let's put it this way then. Why do they use appropriate rather than deprive rather than what the model penal code uses or what Michigan uses and so forth on, I wonder.
It's interesting to know, if I read these correctly, without prejudicing against somebody, but don't they define deprive and appropriate very, very similar in those?
Yes.
Are they exactly the same?
Well, to deprive another of property means A, to withhold it or cause it to be withheld from him permanently or for so extended a period or under such circumstances that the major portion of its economic value or benefit is lost to him, or B, to dispose of the property in such manner under such circumstances that has would render it unlikely that an owner will recover such property. And appropriate means to appropriate property of another to oneself or a third person means to exercise control over it, or to aid a third person to exercise control over it permanently or for so extended a period, or under such circumstances as to acquire the major portion of its economic value or benefit, or B, to dispose of the property for the benefit of oneself or a third person.
The economic factor is the same.
It's the economic factor. One is withholding it, the other is exercising control over it. But I don't think it's redundant. My own thought is that the one complements the other, and they're both necessary if we're going to have a fraud larceny statute. Wouldn't you agree, Professor?
Abandoning it out someplace, you're no longer exercising any control over it. Perhaps you have deprived, in that case, the owner of.
Yes. Chairman, I'm not trying to sound anything, but I'm saying it's going by too fast. It seems to me that deprived is maybe a better word than appropriate, and appropriate as that if I'm a thief, but look, I've got it, I'm using it for me, or I'm getting the economic benefit out of it, whereas deprived would cover every circumstance. But I'm just wondering if this is going to be a slow process, because I think that some of those things should be talked about and thought about as we go along, and as you go along, and I'm not sound. Goes by too fast for me to keep up with it, but go ahead.
All right. Now, don't let me do all the talking, but I want to push it along and interrupt me whenever you want. But I notice in your draft two that you've omitted take. And of course, if you look at 164, whatever it is, 310, the classical definition of larceny, as we know it, and as a common law, anyone who willfully takes, carries, leads, steals, etc.
unnecessary to have a definition for that, isn't it?
For taking. I think these other definitions cover that, and I think if we included a definition of take in there, I think that we're staying with the traditional concept of larceny, that there has to be a taking. And this, I think this is what we want to get away from.
Yeah, this is what we want to get away from. We want to get, at the common law, you had to take in the sense that you physically got control. That was the caption, and there had to be the aspiration, even if it's only for an inch. A whole lot of monkey business, historical stuff that you can dispose of it. That if I deprive you of the thing by some other kind of a ruse, I sell you Bruce Spaulding's hogs, and you drive them away. And I didn't take them, and I didn't move them. And you weren't my agent because you didn't do it for me. But by golly, Bruce hasn't got them anymore, and he's out them. And I've got the economic benefit out of it, and he's been deprived.
You can't sell a broken bridge anymore.
This kind of thing, I think, although I may not have thought that in that broken bridge was too enough.
Of course, that's what necessitated the statutory crime of embezzlement. Was because you didn't have this take
aspiration,
this taking away. You had
rightful possession.
You had rightful possession and a wrongful conversion.
So that's my next question. We're doing away with the aspiration requirement.
I think we should.
In the first draft, on the second page, 2A, there were some definitions of the joint or common owners of property, and the person who obtained possession of property by theft or other illegal means of being who have a right of possession superior to that of the person who obtained or withholds it from him by larcenous means. Now, you omitted those, Kathleen.
Well, I didn't omit them in the sense that they're omitted from the total draft. Don, did you pull the stat the top of the draft I gave you?
Yes.
Well, you're finding material that on page 8, right of possession. My reason for making a suggestion is that it's a little hard within the general system of our code to consider what is written on this right of possession as really being definition. We're talking about describing a situation from which a certain thing follows. So my suggestion was that those be dealt with not as definitions, but as, insofar as the crime of larceny is concerned, here is the priority of rights of possession. So who stole from whom?
Now this reappears in section 10.
Right, and as far as I know, that's pretty close, or should be intended to be, very close to what the original draft was. My only suggestion was that
I
think this is exactly the definition.
I
think
that's
all right. That answers that. Well, let's look at section 1. And I've been over two or three times since I've received it. And it seems sufficiently all-inclusive to me. To warrant action. Now, what does the committee say?
With the additional definition of property.
Right.
So we're going to put in.
That's already in place.
Mr. Chairman, I want to raise something, and maybe this will be some difficulty, but. This will affect another part of the code, so I think it ought to be raised this time. This draft uses intent, whereas the model penal code uses purpose. And ultimately, this will affect a lot of the code, and we'll have to make a decision on it. Maybe it's impossible this time to make a decision. Purpose would I think, be the same as specific intent, in effect, and the model penal code has the mental elements laid down as purpose, knowledge, recklessness, and negligence. Now, this does away with an awful lot of common law trappings of the distinction between specific intent, general criminal intent, for instance, all kinds of complicated homicide
involved in the mental element of murder or his malice aforethought. So whatever you do with this, you may have to come back to it later to make the mental element uniform with the mental element that's made uniform for other crimes.
Well, don't understand that there's another subcommittee working on the mens rea requirements.
When it gets started, it hadn't done, it hadn't got off of.
I expect that we're going to have to come back probably.
Yeah, these are all going to have to be reevaluated in the light of the general definitions and decisions that are made with respect to these overall principles. I think it might be premature for us at this time to try to decide definitely on one word or another. But I think you're certainly correct that this may have to be modified later on.
I wasn't saying that. I just wanted to be bearing in mind that it might have to be.
There's another term that's used in here, and whether or not it needs to be defined or not, but I think that same subcommittee wants to consider this very question of person.
Person.
Whether person needs to be defined, particularly when you want to go beyond national person and corporation and states, counties, you know, this sort of thing.
We're going to get into that a little bit later on, where we talk about representative drawer as far as our check statute is concerned, and I don't want to bring it up now, but it reads in the draft to me as though a person is going to be held personally liable for a NSF company check. He's an agent. Did you consider defining person in the definitions?
Well, I didn't, because I think this is one of the things, if you're going to define it for purposes of your criminal code, it's probably a general definition that goes back, you know, at the point of the beginning, but I do notice that 161.010 defines it, and it, the particular reason, not being corporations or persons, but talking about what would be involved in larceny by saying we're a person. Designate part of whose property may be subject to a crime. It includes the state, any other state, government, county, which may lawfully own property in this state, and all municipal, public, or private corporations, as well as individuals. Now, evidently, that question has been raised.
Now, in your first blue binders here, the draft that we went over last time, on the first page of that, I've set out that particular subsection, subsection 11 of 161.010. So that you'd be aware that there is that definition, and I purposely left it out of the larceny draft because I felt that it belonged, it should, and it's going to need to be defined in our criminal code, but I don't think we want it specifically defined in just the section on larceny.
Well, I was thinking of it because of the property, but the state property interest also comes up in what the model penal code anyway relies on very heavily to cover a lot of sections of the American code.
As we go further, we can consider, perhaps other committees consider other things, Mr. Chairman. Section 1.13 of the Model Penal Code, 1.13, subsection 8, reads, each person, he, and actor include any natural person as their relevant, a corporation or an unincorporated association. So what do you think that a governmental entity might be?
There's going to be a vast coordinated effort needed, and we're going to have to probably come back time and again, but and I think it's well for us to be aware of these. But for our purposes here, as we look at this draft, and we look at the definitions first with an eye toward moving on, do I understand from Kathleen and Don and Professor Arthur, who are really the technicians on this, that the definitions that you have put in Section 1 are designed to include larceny, embezzlement, and false pretenses, be all inclusive as far as those crimes in our present code of interest.
Yes.
And the false pretenses, false promise,
well,
not limited to it.
Yeah, it's broader than what we think of as false pretenses now. Yes.
The
definitions were intended to
cover those.
To cover
anything else were they intended to cover?
Not at this time, but I wouldn't be surprised under Burns if progress was drafting in, say, crimes involving property, if you may, we may discover that some of these terms fit and make a very adequate substitute for some synonymous term now used, then it might be better to eliminate the elegant variety that we now have in the law in favor of using some of these terms if we can make them fit. So they might be expanded to include some others, but right now we think they're the basic requisites that we have to have for these, for this bundle of crimes.
And of course, omitting burglary, that's going to be a separate.
Yeah, and that may involve some additional definitions.
Yes, this doesn't include burglary.
All right, well then as we look at Section 1, what's the committee's desire with respect to one? Any other?
Do you want a motion, Chairman?
I think so.
I'll move that we adopt Section 1 with the understanding that the definition of property is going to be included.
As amended to contain that?
Yes.
Okay. Motion made and seconded that Section 1 as amended be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Okay. Now, we'll go now to Section 2 and do you want to preface our consideration of it with your specific comments about this capital?
Well, the specific comment is I noted in me, again, no intention except for this wasn't an intentional thing about the check, which I think is defined as the instance in Larson's English. This rearrangement of material, with my conclusion that it would be nice and handy and useful and perhaps less confusing if, when you're looking up what somebody does to commit larceny, you can find a recital of the specifics. Perhaps a little cryptically described for purposes of a prosecution, but at least described in sufficient detail with a cross-reference so that you can go specifically to the section to get the detail. For instance, if you're reading through it and you're looking for the bad check thing, you have to read through all of the detailed description of what acquiring property lost or mislaid and so forth, you know, sorting through to find the one you're looking for. That this kind of operates as a little bit of an index. These are the acts that constitute larceny. Now, if you want to get the full detail, turn to Section 7 or 5 or whatever. Might be a way to make this easier to use. It's an accessibility argument, I think, more than the one that varies the content or substance of the
section. I think it's a good change.
It's going to create any pleading problems for the people that draw the
documents. That's what I was wondering.
Is it? Okay. In that they have to allege both the specific thing and the section of which and the specific.
Well, the Supreme Court says the indictment has to be framed in the language of the statute. Now, by dividing it down, we're going to require the indictment to be framed only in the language of the. Only in the. General language of the statute or in the whole thing. My thought hasn't crystallized on that, but it was plaguing me when I was going over this earlier. You're an expert in this area, Don.
Well, there's one way that this can be handled, and I think, and retain this structure that Kathleen has suggested, which I think is a good one. And that is, we could include or add to the draft a definition on pleading, a section on pleading and proof. proof, which says, in fact, that your indictment is sufficient if it alleges that the defendant stole property without designating the particular way in which the property was stolen.
That kind of puts the defendant at a disadvantage.
It does, and some of the states, now Connecticut, I believe, the Connecticut Commission rejected this. They felt that this created an undue hardship on the defendant. New York apparently didn't.
Now, wait a minute. If there were discovery for the defendant, like is trend in some states, that would be another question. Is it criminal discovery in New York to explain there using that, allowing that generally?
Well, there are discovery provisions in their code. I can't tell you with any degree of accuracy how extensive they are, but I think that this is such a fundamental policy thing that I purposely left it out of the initial draft here, hoping that we could discuss this matter, but I think it's the type of provision that you're going to get an awful lot of violent reactions and tension and stuff. I don't know, maybe not. This is just one way that this could be handled from the pleading standpoint. And that's with the exception, they go on to say, in this proof that the defendant engaged in any conduct constituting larceny is sufficient to support any indictment, information, or complaint for larceny other than one charging larceny by extortion. But that goes to the matter of proof rather than plea. This is would not be unanimously accepted, I'm sure, by defense attorneys.
Well, now this is a section peculiar only to the larceny section in the New York Code, isn't it?
Yeah, this is on larceny pleading proof, right?
Now, do they have similar pleading and proof sections in robbery, for example? I can foresee the same sort of a pleading problem going all through this. I'm wondering if.
No, they don't.
You don't know particulars except that didn't give you full discovery, but like we do in the federal court a bit.
The funny thing on this discovery thing, the highly touted Vermont statute, you know, the ABA had a big article on it. Vermont solved all its criminal discovery statute problems and so forth by adoption of this particular statute. So I said we got a copy of the statute from one of the members of the legislature, and it's almost verbatim the discovery statute that's now on the books in Oregon.
Since 1961. Oh. Well, bill of particulars would be a way of getting around it. On the court-appointed cases, it would afford the counsel another opportunity for a court appearance and another $50 in his cost bill, and I'm sure that the county commissioners wouldn't like that.
Let me ask a question about discovery. Is it possible to so draft the discovery statute that if the defendant wants to avail himself of it, that the state could then demand he be placed on the witness stand and so on.
Constitutional. Mm-hmm.
That would be unconstitutional. Well, with this provision, it would still be unconstitutional.
Yeah.
If they chose to use this part of it, then they would stipulate that the defendant would waive some of his constitutional rights.
A little coerced.
He couldn't let him do that.
A little coerced.
Particularly with the court leading in the direction it is now, that discovery maybe is an intrinsic and inherent part of the defendant's rights.
But there is some place.
Yeah, boy.
There is a movement in the area of discovery where the defendant availing himself of discovery uses an alibi defense, that he's required to make a disclosure.
Certain disclosure.
Yeah, and it's kind of running in tandem with what you suggest, Ed, only it doesn't go that far.
There's a part of the testimony of the defendant himself.
No, but it puts certain responsibilities on him with respect to disclosure to the DA.
The Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure has a provision whereby if the defendant makes his demand for discovery, that the government's attorney has certain rights, not to to the point of cross-examining or the witness or whatever, but certain rights as to the papers, documents, and so forth in the possession of the defendant, that the court in its discretion may grant.
It's almost like a deposition.
It might be, depending on what they had in their hands at the time. And there's certain limitations both directions, what the defendant cannot gained by discovery and what the government cannot gain.
If you have discovery, you certainly have to have the ability to wipe out this alibi, I think, because you might as well not have the trial.
Well,
not have full discovery.
That's the biggest fear on the part of the prosecution.
You might as well just get the trial.
But I'm sure, again, that this is something that will probably be the most hotly contested area of the committee's consideration, and we'll be getting to it. But looking back,
well, now
at the question that Mr. Spall and I both had with regard to the pleading.
Well, now, of course, the way that this Section 2 now has been drafted by Kathleen, you're incorporating by reference these other sections. Even without the probation here with respect to plea, I don't really see why it would be any problem from the standpoint of the district attorney to draft an indictment charging larceny committed in a manner specified by one of these subparagraphs, utilizing the language that would appear in the section that's referred to under your basic larceny. In other words, if he's charged with committing larceny by embezzlement, or better say, you would allege that, if he's and allege the manner in which this was accomplished by the defendant, if he's charged with committing larceny by extortion, the extortion language, as it appears in Section 6 of this Act, could be incorporated by the district attorney in his indictment. I would think the same as it would if it were set out here. I don't really see where that would be a particular problem from the standpoint of pleading.
All right, now here we have a problem, and I'm a defense attorney, and I'm looking at the technical defenses that I have, and you're the DA, and you allege that I committed larceny by embezzlement under, say, Chapter 100, the General Larceny Statute.
Right.
Embezzlement happens to be 100 sub A. False pretenses happens to be 100 sub B. All right. It's alleged in there, or on about the 10th day of December, committed larceny by embezzlement, so on and so forth. The judge holds on my motion for judgment of acquittal that you didn't prove larceny by embezzlement, you proved larceny by false pretenses. We're still within the same general section. My motion for judgment of acquittal lie, can the judge send that case to the jury? You see what I'm getting at?
I wouldn't suggest, and I know Donald, that would be the way you would draw it. So my thought would be you'd have guilty of larceny by issuing bad check to wit, he on, and then going with the language of the statute for a bad check on such and such a date did issue to so and so, et cetera, however much of the detail you then put in. But not that it would say to wit and violate the section of the book.
Yeah.
That I was thinking of a more specific tie-in than that.
considered, Mr. Chairman, as a consideration given to the way the Montefiore Code is handled, I'm not sure that it's satisfactory, but